My name is Carrie Ginger and your host of the Biteable podcast, Know Better, Live Best. Today's guest is Rebecca Thistlethwaite, the director of the Niche Meat Processor Assistance Network based at Oregon State University. Listen as we discuss how to understand food labels and what to look for when purchasing food for you and your family. Know Better, Live Best is dedicated to supporting food and health literacy in people of all ages. Our mission is to cut through the misinformation surrounding food, health, and nutrition because we believe that when people know better, they can make the right choices and live their best lives. We are presented by Biteable Foods. They use blockchain and Internet of Things technology to build traceable, transparent food systems because it shouldn't take an investigative journalist to find out where food comes from. I am here with Rebecca Thistlethwaite again. She luckily is joining us on the podcast. And if you missed the first one, she aired in February and it was episode 24. So check it out. Rebecca, thanks for coming on again today.
Thank you for having me.
So since we spoke last, you've actually taken a new role and you are now the director of the Niche Meat Processor Network. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I served as the program manager the last 3 years, and my supervisor has moved into another role at university, Oregon State University. And so now I'm director. We are a national network of meat producers and meat processors and others in the niche meat supply chain. And we're just trying to create a thriving, robust niche meat supply chain so that niche meats, you know, grass-fed, organic, sustainable, are no longer the niche, but they are the norm. So that's the role that I play.
Well, it sounds like a great role, and they're super lucky to have you, that's for sure.
Thank you.
So you were on today to help us out labels. And I know I'm not the only one to say when they've gone to the grocery store that they are just confused because there is so much on a label. That's, can we trust the label? We're looking at nutrition facts and we want to do what's best for our families and our bodies. And it just gets overwhelming. So I'm happy to have you on to help us kind of, you know, dig a little deeper and have a little more confidence when we go shopping for ourselves. So first, when you look at a label, you might see certifications or even just different words on labels. Do you want to go into that for us so we have a little more knowledge?
Yeah, so there's a big difference between what are called label claims. So those are just words, descriptors, and third-party certifications. And so a consumer will usually see those as some sort of emblem or, you know, little circle on a food label. So label claims, whether it be an animal product that has to go through the USDA to get their label claims approved, or the FDA if it's another type of food product, generally they only have to submit really minimal documentation to justify those words they put on their labels. And so some of the examples are things like the word natural or hand harvested or farm raised or any number of fancy words that food manufacturers use to try to make their product out to be something better than other stuff on the shelf. And in this, it's essentially meaningless. The word natural, for example, really only means that you can't add preservatives or sodium to the final product. So it really only has to do with the actual processing of that product. It has nothing to do with how that vegetable or that animal was actually raised. You know, there's natural doesn't mean anything for the production. Whereas certifications are third-party organizations that will actually come out and inspect or audit your farm. And in some cases, you know, everything from the soil all the way through where it meets the final consumer. And they have standards that you have to follow, and then they check to see if those standards are being followed. And they often come out, you know, anywhere from every year to every 2 years to make sure you're following those standards. So examples of that are like certified organic, animal welfare approved, non-GMO projects, certified humane, fair trade, in the case of like tropical food products, and a few other third-party certifications. So if you are a consumer looking at a label and you see label claims, they really should be backed up with some sort of certification to verify that those claims are truthful.
So definitely go for the foods or the labels that have the certifications, because that's a bit more trustworthy. It's not as misleading.
I would say so. I mean, unless you are buying directly from the farmer and you know exactly how she or he raised it, you believe what they say, you have that kind of relationship. If you're buying it at the store and you don't generally have that kind of relationship, I would say, you know, your best option and most trustworthy option would be to go for the certified products.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the all natural, because I have fallen for that before. And so I was kind of laughing to myself as you're going over it. And I'm like, yeah, I've done that. But you're sitting there in the aisle and like I said before, it's overwhelming. And you're like, oh, all natural. I mean, natural just always sounds good. And I can't say I was always confident in the choice, but at that moment, how much time do you have? And you're getting in the grocery store, you have a toddler in the cart. And so you just grab and go.
Yeah.
It's better to be prepared before you go to the store. I will say that. However, I do appreciate you bringing up the all natural. So there's a lot more that goes into the label that I'm hoping you help us out with, because I have friends and family members, and I think there's a lot of different opinions on this. So we might run into things like non-GMO. And maybe this is important on some labels and not on others. Do you want to help us out with that?
Yeah, so non-GMO means that the crop right now it only applies to plants, but that the crop was not the seed itself wasn't genetically engineered, and you know the most common genetically engineered crops are things like soy, corn, sugar beets. What are the other? Those are kind of like the top three. There's about a dozen, I think, that are commercially available. Most food products are not genetically engineered. The seed itself is not genetically engineered, or it's not commercially available. And so you see non-GMO label on a lot of foods that aren't genetically engineered anyways. And so it's often being used as a marketing tool to differentiate itself, but it's the same exact product as any other conventionally grown product out there, you know, like strawberries or orange juice, for example. There's not genetically engineered oranges yet anyway, and nor is there for strawberries. So big business really likes non-GMO label because it allows them to pass a little premium onto the consumer, even though that product is exactly the same as everything else on the shelf. I would say for the few products that are genetically engineered, let's take like a corn tortilla chip. I would pick the non-GMO corn tortilla chip over one that doesn't have it. But even better would be, I would actually pick the certified organic corn tortilla chip, because certified organic is not only, but also they can't use synthetic pesticides, herbicides, or fertilizers. So it's a much further step environmentally. So yeah, that's sort of non-GMO in a nutshell.
So it's kind of like a buzzword on most things. It really just, you're paying for the words on the packaging, except for when it comes to, like you said, like soy and corn and items where you might actually purchase that. And then you do really want to pay attention to that certification.
Yeah. And the level of understanding of the average consumer in this country and probably most of the world about genetic engineering is really low, because it's a very scientifically dense topic and controversial and nuanced. It's a very nuanced topic. I mean, there might be some uses of genetic engineering that would be very beneficial. I'm not sure what they are at this point, but I think consumers, they just see that and they think, oh, this is like a more environmentally sustainable product, but they don't actually know that that those crops still get the same amount of herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers put on them. And in fact, many of the herbicides that they use for non-GMO crops are actually more toxic than the Roundup, than the genetically engineered ones. So for example, in corn, the genetically engineered corn gets Roundup as the herbicide. The non-GMO corn gets atrazine as the herbicide, which is actually immensely toxins and amphibians. So so the trade-off isn't always great on that.
But that's interesting. You're going to think of that differently when you go to the grocery store and see the non-GMO label. And it just goes to show how much more we need to learn about what goes into our food when we're shopping. So,
yeah, I know.
Thanks for that information. So organic, I find this really interesting because I've heard a lot about organic. I feel maybe that's something I know a little more about than some of these other labels. I feel that I've heard like the Dirty Dozen. There's maybe some things you may not have to purchase organically, or there are some items that your produce that you really want to purchase organic, whether it's meat or produce, fruits and vegetables. What are your thoughts on that?
I think certified organic is one of the best labels out there. While there are a couple areas of weakness in that label, I think it far exceeds most of the other labels because it's so comprehensive. It's the fertilizer use, it's your soil management practices, it's the herbicides, it's the pesticides, it's preservatives and other ingredients that they add to the food products. So it's pretty comprehensive. Certainly, if you're on a limited budget and you want to focus on purchasing just organic products that have the highest pesticide burden or things that you can't peel, for example, where you're in direct contact with the fruit or the vegetable without, you know, washing it or peeling it. Things like strawberries, for example, are definitely one of the most toxic, but maybe like a banana or an orange where you get to peel it, it's less important. But I don't really think of these certifications so much in terms of just my personal health. I think that is actually, for me, it's the least important factor. I know for most consumers, it's the most important factor. But I'm looking at environmental health, and I'm also looking at the health of the workers. So I don't want to purchase anything, whether or not I peel it or not, where the farm workers are having to spray it and being exposed to it and on a daily basis, or the communities that live next to it have to live around that all the time. That's not okay for me. That's not an okay trade-off for me to be able to save a few pennies on my food. So,
well, an organic something, at first it seemed, years ago, it seemed pretty expensive to me, but since then it's where I want to spend my money, or I find myself spending my money at the grocery store more often than not. I think especially since having children, you see their little mouths eating it, but it is something that I think is worth the money to my family. And so I have purchased that. And especially, like you said, when it came to the grapes and the strawberries, the items that you can't peel. But I've since moved into majority of my produce being organic, but I think I need to look a little harder at the certification label as opposed to just maybe seeing the word organic. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, if it says organic on it, it's regulated by the federal government, and you can't slap that label on anything without being third party certified. Certified. You can trust that label. I mean, there are the rare instances of fraud, but unlike all the other certifications, organic is actually regulated by the USDA, and any imports even coming into the country with organic, they check it at the border and they have an extensive paper trail for it. So you can feel, pretty confident in that label.
Oh, that is really good to know. Because like I said, the overwhelming part, and I felt better about organic, but I wasn't sure of the guidelines. And that's something I need to learn more about. But it's nice to know you can't just like, so I wasn't sure if there's maybe only just certain things you had to do to meet organic or if it was all around. So this is really, really great to know.
I mean, it takes 3 years just to get certified. Your land has to be without chemicals for 3 years. The documentation, I mean, farmers will complain about it, but it's about 75 pages of documentation. It's not, it's a pretty high hurdle that you have to get over.
They're working for that label. That's good to know.
Yeah.
So as you know, after we pick up the produce, then we pick up some eggs at the grocery store, and oh my goodness, is there a wide range of what you can buy aside from just opening up, make sure they're not cracked, but let's go over some, you know, some of the types of eggs we might find, such as pasture raised. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little about pasture raised when we see that?
Yeah, so pasture-raised is kind of the gold standard when it comes to raising chickens, but there's not necessarily a certification for it. I think a couple other certifications, like Animal Welfare Approved, require access to pasture, but the word itself, when a farmer wants to put it on his egg carton, they have to submit, you know, like an affidavit to the FDA to get that word. But the FDA doesn't ever come out and inspect and see if you're actually following that standard. I don't think that there's probably many producers using pasture-raised and lying about it, but it could happen. But that basically means that the chickens have access to grazing, you know, during daylight hours, and then they typically go inside some hen house at night for protection from predators. And chickens are not ruminants, so they're not getting a huge amount of their diet from the pasture, but they could get anywhere from like 15 to 30% from the grass and the bugs that they're eating out of the pasture, which is a more natural diet, and it produces a more nutrient-dense egg. You know, there's higher levels of vitamin A and omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D, and in some cases even lower cholesterol. So it's a healthier product for the human as well.
Okay, so obviously much better for the chickens as well with everything you went over.
Yeah.
So that sounds a lot like free range, but from what I know about that, free range can mean a lot of different things. So
free range is probably one of my least favorite label claims, because the word range actually means pasture. That is the definition of range. It's not the verb range, which is to range, to walk around, right? So free range eggs come from chickens that are allowed to walk around inside big barns. And they may have, you know, there may be 100,000 birds in that barn, and maybe there's a door or two for the birds to go outside for a little bit if they can climb over all 100,000 other birds to get to that little door. But it doesn't require that they have outdoor access at all. So it's usually just a darkly, barely lit barn with a lot of dust and cobwebs. I've been inside some of them. They smell really bad, and the birds are not in cages, at least, but they are packed pretty tightly inside a barn.
That doesn't sound like a great living condition, you know, for those birds to do, because what you just described with pasture raised seems like, you know, the way it should be. But when you hear free range, I think that's what a lot of consumers picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's not worth hearing.
That's not the case. A few, like you said, a few, or I'm not sure how many, might get out if they find the door or they're close to the door and not in the middle of the pack. But that's that ranging when you're stuck, you know, wing to wing with the next bird. So then we're kind of going down the list here. Cage free, which the free range is cage free. Like I said, they're not in a cage. So what's the difference between cage free and pastured eggs versus free range?
Cage free and free range are basically the same. They're just outside of cages inside a big barn. But I think some of the big egg manufacturers like to use the word free range instead of cage free, because then it makes consumers think that they're outside when, as I said, that's not the case. So they're interchangeable, cage free and free range.
This is going to help me a lot when I go to the store. Is it hard to find pasture raised eggs?
You know, there's more and more national brands that are doing it by working with a number of smaller producers and then aggregating their eggs. And so I just was at a store yesterday and I actually saw two pasture raised brands at that store. And then at my local farmers market, there's probably four farmers there doing pasture raised eggs. So yeah, I'm sure there's parts of the country where you can't find it, but it's becoming more and more popular.
Which is what I like. I have with actually many things, it's getting easier to find even just more organic, or there's just more options, I feel, because I think that's the consumer, you know, the demand part. And so it's wanting to come out, which I think is great. It helps us all. But that does help with the eggs, because I've seen the free eggs. Well, absolutely. It's like you want to get the information out there so that you drive demand, because I bet a lot of people are buying free range eggs and cage free and feeling pretty good about it, because you're paying a decent amount more money for those eggs. Yeah. Versus the other cartons. And so I think you feel like you're doing a good thing for your family when you may not be. And that's the intent. If you're willing to spend the money, then let's find the right labels to look into or the certifications. Grass-fed. So, I mean, I think I could obviously guess on this or fed grass, but is it like the pasture raised, or is it just another word they put on the label? Whether it's grass-fed, you know, beef or...
So grass-fed is for ruminant species, which are the species that are, you know, evolutionarily designed to break down fiber in their guts. So beef, sheep and goats are the primary ruminants that we eat in this country. So grass-fed applies to them. Pasture-raised is typically for omnivores like pigs and poultry, because they're also getting grain. They can't just live on the grass alone. But you may see pasture raised in the term of beef, and that typically means that the beef had access to graze, but it was supplemented with some grain, which is not necessarily a bad way to go. Some Americans still like the taste of grain-finished animals, and you know, if you live in an area that doesn't have great grass production, or you're trying to finish animals in the winter time when the grass isn't really growing, having some access to some nutritionally sufficient grain like barley or winter wheat is not necessarily a bad thing. But grass-fed, if you see that on a label, well, typically it says 100% grass-fed. If it doesn't say 100% grass-fed, then the animal probably ate grass up until the last few months of its life, which is true for most beef. And then they spend maybe the last 3 or 4 months on grain, fattening on grain. 100% grass-fed means basically as soon as it's weaned from its mom, it only eats grass or hay the whole rest of its life until it's harvested. And so a lot of consumers want that for health reasons. It tends to be healthier for the animal because it supports the right kind of pH in their gut and makes them less susceptible to E. coli and other pathogens. It also just is, you know, the evolutionarily appropriate diet for those species. If you see 100% grass-fed in this country, it does mean that some documentation was provided to support that claim. There's a lot of countries being imported now from Australia and Uruguay. About 85% of it is imports. And the paper trail is not as good for the imported beef and lamb because it just the distance and the amount of hands that that meat has changed before it reaches the country. There has been some instances of in grass-fed. So you could look for a product that was also certified grass-fed. So it has that claim of 100% grass-fed, but it's been third-party certified. And a couple good certification companies in terms of that are American Grass-Fed Association, or Animal Welfare Approved also has a certified grass-fed label as well. And that means they actually came out to your farm, they went through your whole paper trail, and they come out and visit, you know, every year or two to make sure you're following the rules.
Okay. So obviously you want the certification with the grass-fed, and that's a good label. You definitely want to look at, and you can feel good buying it. If it does not have the certification, but it says grass-fed, is that just kind of, you're just taking your chance and maybe still a good option if there's not a certification, or?
I'd say it's better than nothing. I mean, I prefer a more grass-fed animal over grain-fed. You know, it's likely that it's coming from far away. You know, the other thing about the imported grass is most of it's pretty lean. These are not prime quality animals. So it may not be an excellent eating experience, I would say. The quality that you're going to get from American grass-fed and domestic grass-fed is going to be probably a lot higher.
Oh, awesome. Amazing. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier in the podcast, fair trade.
Yeah.
Can you give us more information on that? And what fair trade is exactly for the listeners out there?
Yeah. My knowledge of fair trade is not as deep, but the idea is that the farmer is receiving a premium over the standard commodity prices. And it's supposed to be a premium that allows them to have a living wage and feed their families. This is typically in tropical food products that's grown by lots of little tiny farmers like tea or coffee or cacao, chocolate products, a lot of domestic fair trade. You know, in the case of coffee, This was a long time and what it's like now, but the premium was about 14 cents a pound more on fair trade coffee going back to the farmer than the non-fair trade coffee. And that was, you know, supposed to give the farmer a better life. And a lot of these fair trade companies are organized as cooperatives. And so that actually helps the farmer see even more of the consumer dollar because there's less intermediaries. And I know there's some fantastic ones out there that have helped build schools and daycare centers and medical clinics in their villages. So I think, you know, if you are buying those imported food products that come from really far away and from small farmers, it's a way to assure that more of your dollars are going to the people who produce the food.
Well, I think that's important to many people where the money goes back to you. You want to go back to those farmers or whoever producing because they're working hard and half the time they're not getting paid enough for what they're doing. And, you know, we need amazing farmers out there. And I know that's where I want my money going.
Well, when I was doing my master's research in Guatemala, back in the late 90s, I ran into a farmers cooperative that was growing fair trade coffee, and several of their producers said if it wasn't for fair trade, when they had six children and they got to decide who they sent to school, and these are countries where school is not free, and they had a couple sons and they had a couple daughters, having a fair trade premium allowed them to make enough money to be able to send their daughters to school. For me, I'm like, if that's the difference between educating all of your children or not, absolutely, I'll pay, you know, an extra dollar on my bag of coffee beans, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And that's, I mean, that is an amazing story. And I think those are the stories that we need to hear more of. Because, you know, we get used to our life here and what we're doing and even the school systems that are available to all of our children, but that's not the way everywhere. And if we can support that and help them in any way we can, like you said, an extra dollar or two, that's not going to change our weekly budget a whole lot. So think of it that way when maybe you want to complain about how expensive things are, but you're also paying for that quality of, you know, the produce or the meat, but also helping that farmer that produced that. And I like that you're bringing up all these positions on the labels because it's something everyone can think of when they go to the store next. So you brought up a lot of interesting things for when I go to the store next. So I know I'll be looking organic. We can feel really good about organic labels when we're buying our produce. The grass-fed certification is great when it has actually the certification, pasture-raised eggs, and definitely being careful of what's labeled non-GMO, because like you said, most items would have that label no matter what. It's just something they're putting on the bag. But what are some of the most important things to you when you're looking at a label?
Yeah, well, I'm going to differentiate between animal products and non-animal products, because there's a couple that relate to animal products. You know, animal welfare obviously doesn't apply to vegetables, but I think for non-animal products, for me, certified organic, I'm also interested to know where it's grown. So I always like to keep my dollars in my region if possible. So I'm looking for local or regional brands, or at the very least product of the USA. And it's not that I don't want my dollars going to other countries, but it's more about the traceability and transparency of the products. And, what else? Organic, local product of the USA, fair trade, and I think those are kind of my main criteria. You know, obviously it's got to be high quality and taste good and least processed, you know, those are the other things. And it's funny we're talking about labels because I actually, most of the foods I buy don't even have a label on them. That's sort of like my criteria number one is look for things that don't have a label. So, you know, I shop the outside of the grocery store and, most of the things I buy don't even have a label on them. So that's probably the first thing I look for. And then for animal products, organic, grass-fed or pasture-raised. And then another thing that is super important to me is something to do with animal welfare practices. So have it be either animal welfare approved or certified humane. That has a whole set of standards relating to how the animals are treated while they're alive, whether or not, you know, their tails can be clipped or their ears notched or their teeth clipped or raised in a gestation crate, like a small little crate versus having a lot of space. A lot of things having to do with quality of life for the animal. You know, I eat animal products, but I want those animals to have an amazing life and, you know, maybe one bad second in their life. And then even the animal welfare approved certified humane also require really pretty strict slaughter techniques as well. So those things are important for animal products for me. And then as well, the USA is another important one.
That's great to know. And I like how you brought up the traceability and the transparency of the food as well as important to you. And like I said, it's not that we don't want to support other countries, but you know, we live in the US and we want to make sure we're also supporting those around us. And like you said, even in your own region, and helping the farmers around there. And it doesn't take as long to get to your table either.
5 miles. I mean, that's certainly an interest of mine, keeping it as short as possible. But also, I want to see agriculture survive and thrive in the U.S. I don't want to see it all paved over with housing developments. And if we don't have a thriving agricultural sector, we're going to continue to lose ranch lands in this country. And that is just devastating because we have some of the richest topsoil on the planet. So the more we can support local regional production, the more likely those farmers will keep their land in production.
Oh, absolutely. And it's happening really quickly. We can see new neighborhoods going up everywhere, even just, you know, where I live right now, I'm constantly seeing. And then when more developments are going up, I'm looking at the land. I'm like, oh, I bet it's not long before that's gone as well as it's growing. So it is hard to see, because we do want, you know, like you said, the food here in the U.S. and less miles, but also supporting the farmers that are here. So thank you for all those points. So if you had one takeaway from today on labels for our listeners, what would it be?
I think my one takeaway would be look for third-party certifications. Don't just rely on cute, warm, fuzzy words to make your shopping decisions. If they are not backed up by some sort of certification, then most of them are meaningless. Big food manufacturers thrive on the consumers being duped by those warm, fuzzy words. So if you can, look for the third-party certification.
That's extremely important, because hopefully the next time I go to the store, I won't be, you know, confused by the all natural and keep buying. Well, Rebecca, you really helped out the listeners tonight, and I think we all can go to the store the next time with a little more confidence when we look at the labels and know more about what they mean, and we can make more informed decisions. And that's really what we want. So I do appreciate your advice for our listeners out there, and thanks again for joining us. We are very lucky to have you on the Biteable Podcast, and I hope you have an amazing rest of your evening. I'm going to back up just a little bit. I got a little excited with everything I've learned. But if our listeners want to find you or have a question for you after today's podcast, where can they locate you?
Probably the best way to find me is on my personal website. It's also where I do consulting and sell my books. And that's just RebeccaThistlethwaite.com. I know that's a little hard to spell, but hopefully they can get it from your podcast.
Yes, we'll put that down for everyone who wants to look.
And if they want to learn involved in the meat industry and animal production, they can go to nichemeatprocessors.org and find out more about my work there.
Amazing. Well, thanks again so much, because I'm sure some will have questions, but I know they'll have a few less going to the grocery store after tonight. So thanks again. All right. Well, thanks for all your time and your knowledge and sharing with our listeners.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Have a great night.
You too.
We'd like to remind our audience that the views of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of Biteable or of our staff personally. The purpose of the Biteable Podcast is to encourage spirited dialogue around topics like food, nutrition, animal and human welfare, and the food system. Part of having an open and spirited dialogue is accepting that others have views that are different than ours and working to understand how their experiences have differed from our own. We encourage all listeners to do their own research on any and all topics discussed during the show. That being said, we hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thanks for listening.